Welcome to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. Along with my brother Rick, we examine current events in the light of God's prophetic word. This week, we'll be focusing on Passover. That's what we have planned to talk about this week. Pesach in Hebrew, it's the celebration of the Jewish people reliving, retelling the story of the exodus of the Israelites from out of slavery in Egypt. Rick, a lot is happening in our world today, and obviously we can't focus on everything that's taking place.
That's right. And around the world, Jimmy, there's been so many things going on, protests, heartbreak, tragedies, political upheaval, all these things taking place. We keep an eye on these things. But I tell you what, Jimmy, if I didn't know, we study Bible prophecy to be assured that we know how this story is going to end. If I didn't know that, I don't know how I'd make it through this.
Yes. Bible prophecy does help us to understand that. We've got our broadcast partner standing by today, Ken Timmerman, David Dolan, Winky Medad, Shram Hadian, Steve Herzig, and the Legacy Series. Well, let's get started with our first, Ken Timmerman.
Well, that's right, Jimmy. I have our good friend Ken Timmerman with us. He joins us to talk about geopolitical affairs around the world. He's an author, an analyst. You can find out more about him. Sign up for his newsletter by going to kentimmerman.com. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rick.
Well, Ken, we talk just about every week, and a lot has happened since we talked last week on a geopolitical scale, especially when you look at the Middle East and Iran and Israel. Can you give us an update?
Well, you know, last week, Rick, it was before that April 14th attack on Israel by Iran. I believed that the Iranians would not do it. They would not attack Israel directly as they'd been threatening, because such an attack would green light an Israeli response on the Iranian homeland, and that would be devastating to the Islamic regime. And you know what? I was wrong. And I was missing a key piece of information, which I'm going to tell our listeners in just one second. But I was reasoning that this coordination that we saw, and we talked about it last week, between U.S. and Israeli officials was really an augur of a joint U.S.-Israeli counterstrike should Iran be so reckless as to attack Israel. You had the head of the U.S. Central Command, Eric Kirilla, in Israel, and a number of other things were going on. But as we learned, that is not what took place. Here is the key piece of information. We learned on Sunday that the Biden administration had actually been talking to the Iranian regime, not just to the Israelis, but to the Iranian regime through Turkey and through Switzerland. Turkey, why? Because their foreign minister, a guy named Hakan Fidan, is very, very close to the Iranian regime. He is their former intelligence minister and has had a deep relationship with Iranian intelligence going back over 20 years. They were sending messages back and forth with him. But the Biden White House, we're told by Reuters, said that the U.S. was not concerned if Iran attacked Israel, as long as they did so, quote, within certain limits. Now, what were those limits? We're told, do not attack civilian targets in Israel. Well, I got to say this. I have many dear friends in Israel, but one of them is a grandfather. We talked yesterday, and he said, you know, civilian targets. There were 10 million people who were woken up at 1:30 in the night. Nationwide, the entire nation was woken up to these air raid sirens. My 12 grandchildren, he said, were terrorized. They thought they were going to get killed by an Iranian missile that night. That is not attacking a civilian target. So my fear with all this is that people like Jake Sullivan, who is the national security advisor here in the United States and who clearly was directing these back channel talks with Iran. He also, by the way, has a long history of doing this. My fear is that Jake Sullivan sees war as a video game. He saw these 330 Iranian cruise missiles and drones and the ballistic missiles. He saw them, you know, getting shot down in this vast video game. The U.S. and our allies, we took down the 170 drones before they even reached Israel's airspace. We also hit those slow-moving cruise missiles, and all that was zap, zap, bang, bang. That's not the real world. The real world is where you have 10 million people living in fear during the night. The real world is when children are going into bomb shelters. The real world is when, for example, in Sderot, they had 15 seconds warning when their missiles are launched from Gaza. Here they had several hours warning before the Iranian bomb struck. But at any rate, Rick, I wanted to tell our listeners that I got it wrong last week. I think I have a duty to tell you that. And this is why I got it wrong. I was missing that key piece of information that the U.S. actually offered protection to the Iranian regime if they attacked Israel. Extraordinary.
It certainly is extraordinary. And if I could understand what you're saying, Ken, you're essentially saying our most valued ally in the Middle East, Israel, that kind of represents our view toward them, that we would conspire with their biggest enemy and our enemy as well. It kind of looks at the way the Biden administration looks at the Iranian regime. This is very telling for our administration and the way we are handling the situation in the Middle East, isn't it?
I think it is. And, you know, Biden is very, very pro-regime in Tehran. He loves the regime. There are statements going back to 2002 where he thought it was, it was absolutely in our national security to have better relationship with Tehran. Remember, he came into office in 2021 trying to revive the nuclear deal. He only gave that up at the end of last year after the October 7 attacks on Israel by Hamas that were backed by the Iranian regime. And also, by the way, after he was embarrassed when public reports came out of an Iranian influence effort inside the Biden administration, and those agents of influence were actually writing U.S. policy towards Iran. They had written the 2015 nuclear deal. So Biden only backed off his earlier approach towards Iran out of embarrassment.
Well, it certainly is a volatile situation there in the Middle East, and it's an interesting way that things are moving right now. We look at the situation with Saudi Arabia. They actually were involved in helping to shoot down some of those projectiles coming from Iran into Israel, and some people are looking at this as an opportunity for the Biden administration in the United States to restart the Abraham Accords and to push for more peace ties with Saudi Arabia and Israel. Can you tell us why that might be?
Yes. Well, let's be clear. First of all, the Abraham Accords were rejected by Biden when he came into office. He did absolutely zero to pursue them, to try to make them stronger. He ridiculed them. And also in the first 3 months of his presidency, he went out of his way to publicly insult Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia and the de facto ruler of that country. So now he's making an about face and saying, okay, let's see if we can revive the negotiations with Saudi Arabia so they can make a deal with Israel, a peace agreement with Israel. You had Anthony Blinken, who went to Saudi Arabia on March 20th. He met the crown prince in Jeddah. They talked about, some kind of possible deal that could be made. Apparently, the United States is offering Riyadh a more formal defense relationship, as well as access to civilian nuclear power technology. And we're told that in exchange, the Saudis want a Palestinian state. Now, this is the big problem. It's not just a sticking point. It's a non-starter. Benny Gantz, who's an opposition leader but part of the war cabinet, has said that he favors this kind of deal, but he's about the only one. Netanyahu has said there's absolutely not going to be a Palestinian state anytime in the near future until you have total de-radicalization. We've talked about this on this program many times, Rick. When you have the UNRWA UN school books teaching genocide to Palestinian children starting at the age of 2 and 3, that is no way to make a peace agreement. But look, the U.S. is trying to put this back on track. The Saudis are not against the idea, and we'll have to see where it leads. I'm a little bit skeptical for the time being because I just don't see any flexibility on Israel's point, nor should they be flexible on the creation of a Palestinian state. You know, you had on Friday, Rick, a vote at the United Nations to unilaterally declare a Palestinian state. And thank God this time the United States abstained. We've done it in the past, but recent behavior by the U.S. at the U.N. threw that into question. And I'm glad to see that the United States abstained on that resolution.
Well, Ken, that was actually a veto, wasn't it?
You're right, Rick. Thanks for correcting me. They vetoed the resolution, not abstained.
Well, Ken, we're going to talk more about the Middle East in our next segment with Dave Dolan, but I'd like to move on here and let's talk about Russia. The CIA director warned this week that the Ukraine could lose the war with Russia by the end of the year unless the U.S. send more aid. Also this week taking place, Poland arrested a man suspected of an assassination attempt on President Zelensky of Ukraine. Can you talk about these two incidents?
Sure. The CIA director, Bill Burns, is again beating the war drums. He does this regularly. The administration does it as well. They're trying to embarrass Republicans in Congress to pass this $60 billion aid package for Ukraine, which has no accountability in it for where the aid is going to go. We have no accountability for the $130 billion we've given them so far, and there's no accountability for this additional $60 billion. So this is really a political tactic by Bill Burns. However, it is true, Zelensky has said the same thing, that without fresh supplies from the United States, Ukraine will be losing territory in the coming months to Russia. And Rick, it's really just a simple numbers game. Russia is has three times the manpower of Ukraine, three times the population. They are churning out ammunition, you know, large caliber ammunition, 152 millimeter artillery shells, for example, at just enormous rates. It dwarfs anything that Ukraine and its allies can do. So in a war of attrition, Russia wins, Ukraine loses, and that's kind of where we are now. This assassination attempt is extremely interesting and dangerous. The Polish intelligence arrested a Polish man who reportedly was spying on behalf of Russia. He was planning to give secrets of this airport in southeastern Poland along the border with Ukraine to Russia. The significance is that this airport is a gateway for Ukrainian officials to go to the West, including Zelensky. I would not be surprised that Putin wanted to try to assassinate Zelensky. All restraints, I think, are off in this war at this point, except for the use of nuclear weapons. So this is important intelligence. The Germans have also arrested a couple of Germans who were spying for Russia as well. So I am not surprised to see Russia use espionage against Ukraine, which right now is its enemy on the battlefield. What else is new?
Ken, so many things taking place in the world. You keep us updated on all of them. I wanted to just let our listeners know Ken has a website, kentimmerman.com. Sign up for that newsletter. Ken, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick. God bless.
Well, we've got to take a break, and when we come back, David Dolan with our Middle East News Update, right here on Prophecy Today Weekend.
I'm Todd Morris for Ruth Kramer with Mission Network News. While Iran stirs up growing conflict abroad, their own house is not in order. Tehran entered 2024 without an official budget. Lana Silk with Transform Iran says the people are struggling economically and angry with the government.
They feel completely trapped in the world that they live in right now. And as far as they're concerned, they are forgotten by the West, because all the West sees is their regime with all the negative things at play that the regime is involved in. And so then the West must hate us.
Some Iranians are even questioning the validity of Islam itself. Transform Iran uses television, radio, and social media to reach seekers with the good news about Jesus. Please pray for the people of Iran to know truth and comfort in the gospel. And nearly half of the 50 states in America have legalized recreational marijuana in recent years, and five more could vote to do so in November. The Lighthouse's Brandon Bauer says, even if cannabis is legal in your state, that doesn't make it safe to consume.
Picture this. You've got a drug dealer cutting up their cocaine on a table, packaging it, and then they're cutting up their weed on the same table. People are dying from cross-contamination. We're seeing so much fentanyl in the marijuana here in Indiana. It's crazy.
Despite knowing the risks, roughly 18% of Americans used cannabis last year. Christ can and does break the powerful chains of addiction. If you're looking for a biblical approach to addiction recovery, connect with the Lighthouse at missionnews.org.
Getting help with any addictive substance is a wise move, and the Lighthouse wants to help you with that.
Mission Network News is a listener-supported service of One Way Ministries. Bibles for the World is giving away a free copy of the book, The Legacy of William Carey. Get your copy when you click the banner at missionnews.org. I'm Todd Morris.
Welcome back to Prophecy Today Radio, the program that looks at current events in the light of Bible prophecy. This is the portion of our program where we call it our Middle East News Update. We look at news coming out of the Middle East in general, but Israel in particular. To do that, we are fortunate to have with us today a journalist that has over 30 years of experience reporting from the Middle East and living in Israel, Dave Dolan. Dave, thanks for being with us.
Always glad to be with you, Rick.
Well, Dave, we get together on these Saturdays every week to review what happened in the week, and there was quite a bit that did happen this past week as we look at the situation, the Iranian attack on Israel, the Israeli response. Could you go ahead and give us an overview from your perspective on what took place and why it took place?
Well, Rick, yes, it was just 2 or 3 hours after last week's broadcast at 1 p.m. East Coast time in the United States that the attack began upon Israel. Of course, it was late at night there in the middle of the night. As I had said in that program, I expected Iran would respond. They were making a lot of noise about this killing of these top Iranian generals in Damascus. So it was fairly clear to me they were going to do something. But of course, their response turned out to be much larger and greater than almost anybody was anticipating, with over 350 different rockets, missiles fired at Israel. They were using their advanced drones, their Shahed drones, that they have the enhanced version of what they've sold to Russia in the war in Ukraine. There were all sorts of missiles, 120 ballistic missiles. These are powerful warheads fired at Israel. It only takes 12 minutes for them to be fired. They go way up in the upper atmosphere and then come crashing back down. And the Israeli Arrow system, for the first time, was in operation in actual combat. It's been around for decades, but it's never been used to this degree. They've used it once or twice off, but it successfully took out most of those incoming ballistic missiles. The U.S. took out another 6 or 7, and Jordan and Saudi Arabia helped take out some of the drones that were firing, and cruise missiles. Over 30 cruise missiles were also fired. So Iran obviously was planning to do major damage, and particularly, Rick, we know, to two Israeli Air Force bases. They were planning to wipe them out, the Nevatim base in the south of Israel in particular, and it was struck by one of the 6 missiles that got through, but it was blasted before it could actually hit the ground. They did intercept it, but really only at the last minute. So there was shrapnel and there was damage from that, and a young Bedouin girl was seriously injured when shrapnel fell on her house nearby. And then they struck another base in the north of Israel, but those were mostly taken out successfully. So they intended for a lot of damage to be done, but thank God, and many are saying it was near miraculous, if not miraculous, that nobody was killed directly in all these strikes. The Israelis are not buying the theory that Iran didn't really intend to do any damage. They know that if they hadn't have been uber alert with all of their aircraft up and U.S. aircraft, and even the U.K. sent some of its fighter jets from Cyprus, and they intercepted some of these incoming UAVs, and France was also participating, and the Saudis shot down some over their airspace. So everybody sort of worked together, and that was miraculous in and of itself. And Israel didn't get struck badly, but of course they responded on Friday, just yesterday, early in the morning, 4 a.m, hitting the Isfahan. That is a city about 200 miles south of Tehran. And that's where the Natanz underground nuclear site is, Rick. That's a major Iranian nuclear outfit. Now, it's not the first time, actually, that Israel has struck Isfahan. They've done it 3 or 4 times, actually. But each time they didn't claim it. They hit a building there and badly damaged it several years ago that was making rockets and part of the nuclear program. The Iranians said at the time there was just some minor roof damage, and they said it was infiltrators, the same word they used for Friday evening strike in Iran, that it was infiltrators, came from inside the country. But what was hit, we're told by experts now, was the air defense system for the Natanz nuclear reactor and the Natanz nuclear facility underground. And Israel reportedly successfully destroyed a good part of that anti-missile defense system. That's the Russian 300 version. Iran is pressing to get the 400 version, which is even more advanced. And it was a pretty successful strike. But again, Israel's not claiming it. And Iran has been vague about, of course, all week they were saying they were going to wipe Israel out, basically have an instant response, overwhelming response if they were attacked and all of this stuff. But in the end, they've been fairly quiet about it, and it looks like it may settle down. But, of course, the action continues, especially heavy in Lebanon and from Hezbollah there. And, by the way, the IDF also reportedly struck just a few minutes before hitting Isfahan in South Syria, anti-aircraft missile bases there, and also in Iraq. So Israel did a three-pronged response, it seems, but pretty low-key, and it looks like the Iranians are going to ignore it. But, of course, you never know.
You certainly don't, and you stay tuned right here as we continue to report this information. David, you know as well as I do that the Bible says in the end times there will be a confrontation between Iran and Israel, Iran referred to as Persia there in Ezekiel 38. So this is just a foreshadow of what was to come. So we know that's going to happen in the future, but it looks like things have calmed down. Is that your take on this scenario right now, that maybe both sides are willing to step back and not escalate it any further?
Well, it's very telling that nobody in the Israeli government claimed this strike. The military has not made any claims. We've had several cabinet ministers a comment on it and affirm it, and it's been affirmed off the record, but they're not publicly claiming it. And again, Iran, their foreign minister meeting in New York said the Zionist regime will pay a heavy price. This was privately reported, though, in an Iranian newspaper. We didn't get this on tape. And, you know, but overall, they haven't said anything publicly. And again, saying that this was infiltrators that had hit them, and indicating even that the drones were stationed somewhere inside of Iran. Well, that's nonsense. And actually, we're hearing we heard on Friday afternoon that a new missile system called the Hyperglide was used in this attack. That's an Israeli unmanned vehicle, and it has standoff missiles that can be fired. Now, all of these are unmanned vehicles, so Israel wouldn't have lost any personnel, and we haven't had any reports of Iranian casualties, but there probably were some. But Iran is saying, you know, the noise that you heard was just our anti-missile system in operation. Well, why was it in operation if there wasn't an attack going on? But everybody seems to be glad that they're downplaying it and that Israel is. And of course, that's what the State Department, the President, Biden, and, you know, U.S. leaders otherwise, and U.K. leaders and German leaders, all of them have been asking for a muted Israeli response. And it looks like they got it, but it was a reminder to Iran, we can hit Natanz if we want to. We can get into your airspace whenever we need to. So Israel's response was successful, even if very low-key, and Iran's earlier attack was completely not successful.
Well, David, this is all playing out against the backdrop of the upcoming Passover celebration that begins this week. In the minute or two that we have left here, could you talk a little bit about how the situation in the Middle East, the situation between Iran and Israel, is going to affect Passover? And maybe if you want to give a few recollections of the many Passovers that you spent in Israel.
Well, Rick, of course, it's a different Passover than in the past with this full war going on. But nevertheless, the shops were full on Friday, people doing last-minute shopping before the Monday holiday begins. Of course, families gather and the Passover meal, the Seder, is the center of all that. There were people at the beach in Tel Aviv on Friday. You know, there were no sirens going off. It's actually a lot calmer than it was just a couple months ago when we were still getting regular rocket attacks from Gaza. But again, everyone knows Hezbollah, if they're given the order or just decide themselves to hit any of the cities they could. So people are on alert, but going ahead with the holiday. And, you know, my Seders there were wonderful, Rick. I had a close friend that hosted one in his home every year, and 14 or 15 of us would gather around the table in the living room. We would use a table in there and sit on cushions and have a wonderful meal looking out, his windows did, over the walls of the old city. So when the full moon would come up on that Passover evening, we could see it immediately coming through the window. And it was just a wonderful way to spend Passover. And I'm blessed to have had those times. And I pray for a quiet and blessed Passover for all my friends still in Israel and fighting and, you know, on edge, but looking up. And again, the God of Israel's on the throne, and they've had a miraculous deliverance, frankly.
You've been listening to journalist Dave Dolan talk to us about the situation in Israel and the upcoming Passover. Dave, as always, we appreciate your insight. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
You're always welcome, Rick. God bless.
We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll have Shahram Haidian talking about Iran. We'll have Winky Madad and, of course, the Legacy Series with Dr. Jimmy DeYoung. That's all right ahead on Prophecy Today Weekend.
The book of Revelation is God's final word to man and the timeline of the last days revealed to the Christians. This symbolism-filled example of apocalyptic literature can be difficult to understand, especially when simply reading it from beginning to end. Dr. Jimmy DeYoung's latest book, Revelation, A Chronology, takes a walk through the prophetic book of Revelation in the order that the events will take place, chronologically, sharing insights into its true meaning and doing so in an easy-to-understand and practical way. If you have difficulty understanding the book of Revelation, get your copy of Revelation, A Chronology, and let Dr. Jimmy DeYoung aid you in your understanding of this profound end times prophecy book that God has preserved in His scriptures for Christians in the last days. To order your copy of Jimmy DeYoung's Revelation, A Chronology, call us toll-free at 877-674-3298 or visit our website at prophecytoday.com.
Welcome back to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. Along with Rick, we're examining current events in the light of God's prophetic word. In the next half hour, we have Winky Madad and Iranian-born Shahram Haidian, who is a believer. He's going to come talk to us about the mindset of the Iranian people and what's going on there in Iran. And let me just tell you, I had a great time this last week in Peoria, Illinois with Pastor Joy Watt and the great people at El Vista Baptist Church and a lot of our listeners on the radio stations there, the local stations that came out and made themselves known, and just had a great conference while we were there. As we want to continue, you know, there's a thought process that now there's a ring of fire of nations surrounding Israel that potentially an Israeli-Iran conflict could unfold in the Middle East. And these nations of Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, all of these, as they reach in to attack Israel, we needed to get our good friend Winky Madad. Winky is former mayor of Shiloh. He's got a very good understanding, a great friend of the broadcast. Welcome to the program today, Winky.
Thank you once again for having me on and being able to talk to the listening audience.
Well, Winky, I'm especially appreciative of the fact that you are joining us today because I'm sure you are getting ready for Passover in the upcoming week, and I'd like to ask you about that in a minute. But before I do, I'd like to talk about the political situation in Israel, especially as it concerns the Iranian attack and Israel's response. I spoke to you earlier in the week, and you said that Israel could possibly strike Iranian proxies, potentially in Lebanon or maybe in Yemen. Is that something that you think, is that politically viable for Israel?
Well, let's be more correct. It was a suggestion of mine. And actually, as I saw someone mention, it's not an original thought, but so far, Hezbollah, a Iranian proxy sitting up in southern Lebanon, has actually been doing a lot more damage to Israel, life and limb and property, than Iran has been doing directly. So it's more than justified to say that Israel should be attacking Iran and its proxies, or Iran and its allies, and connect them all together so that the world will realize that one of the original indications for Israel that we were in trouble, I think I mentioned it earlier also, was this surrounding of Israel maneuver by getting southern Lebanon, Gaza, and the Houthis down there in Yemen to begin to encircle Israel, which they have done. And I'm amazed that the world sort of just sits back and doesn't realize where all this is leading.
Well, that certainly does look like it's leading to a particular direction. One thing I wanted to ask you, as we look at this situation in general, Iran has been claiming that they had a great victory because they were able to launch these missiles. They say that this was a success and it's just a taste of more. If Israel strikes back even 1 inch of Iranian soil, there will be a massive response. Does this mess with the psyche at all of the average Israeli? Is there something in Israel, or is there a movement to strike Iran in order to create a deterrence and to make sure that this is that they know that you can give a response?
Well, first of all, I wish them all the more success in the future, if this is the type of success that they're proud of. If I'm not mistaken, close to 50% of the missiles never really made it anywhere. They broke up at the launch pads in midair and eventually fell to the earth. And I hope that's true of future launches. The average in the street Israeli also is very much politically aware. There's a big difference between demanding a response and knowing what the government is going to do because it's under pressure. So it's like always a sort of a twist about here in Israel. We get very angry and we get very assertive against Hamas and southern Lebanon and make demands. And on the other hand, more than enough people are willing to understand that the government is under severe pressure politically and otherwise. We've got replenishing of ammo to deal with. We need the United States, United Nations to thwart a Palestinian state initiative. International relations is very, very complicated, even for me, okay? That's saying something. So most Israelis understand that, even though they may fulminate and chaff at the bit sometimes. And we still got a long way to go. But I just want to make one point before finishing this answer. I mean, just a couple of months ago, or more than a couple of months ago, before October 7th, let's put it this way, we had Israeli ships in the past 2 to 3 years, or Israeli-owned or ships owned by Israelis in a private capacity that were being targeted by Iran. I want to remind everybody about that. I don't have to remind the Americans that Iran took over an American warship, if I'm not mistaken, and kept American sailors prisoner for 1 or 2 days, if I'm not mistaken. So we're all in this together. I don't know why Israel has to be taking the brunt of the criticism of don't do this and don't do that.
We certainly are. Well, you have a very pragmatic approach when it comes to international policy with Israel, but there have been reports coming out this week that if Israel responds in kind to Iran, they say they will think of, quote unquote, changing their nuclear doctrine. Now, this has to be something that concerns Israelis, doesn't it?
My answer, of course, would be yes. Of course, I don't know what their nuclear doctrine is. I think their nuclear doctrine is let's get nuclear arms to attack Israel. If they want to change that and not attack Israel, I'm all for it.
That is true. Well, it's something that we'll have to keep an eye on. Well, this situation has potentially created an opportunity. We look at this situation. Iran is a Shiite Muslim. Most of the Arab world, including Saudi Arabia and many of their neighbors, are Sunni Muslim. Now, there are some out there saying that Israel could seize on this opportunity, the world somewhat condemning Iran for this attack, to create a U.S., Israeli, and potentially Sunni Muslim somewhat of a coalition. Is that a diplomatic opportunity that you see on the horizon?
It is an opportunity, but I must inform you and our audience that not all Sunni Muslims are anywhere moderate in terms of Abraham Accords and like Saudi Arabia, which understands its need for America and therefore is willing to deal with Israel a lot easier. We got Qatar and a few other states like Iraq, etc., that are not that favorable to Israel, and they are Sunni Muslim. So I'm going to sort of limit my comment to say it's not just a Sunni-Shiite divide. There's more involved, and I hope Israeli leaders will be able to take advantage of where it is possible to, what term can I call, split off some of the Sunni nations from their anti-Israel or less than pro-Israel positions and join the Abraham Accords or some other military regional type of setup, as we saw evident in Jordan, which wasn't very happy, but it joined in and participated in the defense of Israel in the long run, even though, of course, they said we were defending Jordanian airspace.
As you said, this is all a very complicated situation, and so we appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your insight into the situation. Well, let's move away from that, and let's focus on Passover that's coming up this week. And as usual, we try to get your thoughts on the Jewish feasts that are taking place, the holy days that come about. We love to hear your stories of what's going on, but this year, obviously, after October 7th, things are a little bit different. The political, the military situation is certainly going to affect the planned Passover celebrations for you in particular, and Israel in general. Can you tell us how that might happen?
Well, first of all, we have over 130 families who still have relatives in Gaza as hostages. And we don't know, A, how many are alive still. And I mention that because, as I tried to point out at my Twitter, or X, whatever they call it, that even Hamas doesn't know how many there are and how many are alive or not, or where they are, which indicates to you that, you know, it's a lot more complicated than anybody can conceive. And, of course, these families are extended families, not only what they say, the nuclear family, the father, mother, son, daughter, brother, sister, but you've got grandparents, you've got aunts and uncles, you've got cousins. So I can see literally thousands of people being very uncomfortable to sit down at the Passover Seder feast on next Monday night. As we discussed here many times, the four cups of wine, the matzah, unleavened bread, and all the ceremonial foods and recitations that go on that remind us that we left Egypt, having been slaves there, and came back eventually to Israel. Before I finish this, though, I must say that I have seen radical progressive Jews who are not pro-Israel, who are having liberation seders, liberation, you know, Passover feasts, on behalf of Palestine, which, again, is the most ridiculous thing possible. I mean, the whole, you know, end result of Passover was coming back to the land of Israel, and these guys want to turn it around. I really don't know how we managed to move through history with people like this.
Well, that certainly is hard to explain. You mentioned your Twitter, Winky. For those who would like to follow Winky, you can go to Twitter, and his handle, I guess what they would call it, is at Y-Medad, Y-M-E-D-A-D. You could find out Winky's thoughts, listen to his tweets, see what's going on. I encourage our listeners to do that. But Winky, as we finish up here, one thing I would like from you, you are in the land right now. If we were to see you and we were to express a greeting for Passover, what would we say to you?
Well, there are two, and I presume you're talking in Hebrew. So we'll have a brief Hebrew lesson for all the many people listening. Most observant Jews would say Chag Kasher V'Sameach, which means it should be a kosher and happy holiday. Because one of the most difficult things, for those who do not know, for Passover, is keeping a kosher kitchen, because we get rid of all the bread or anything that could be leavened. So a lot of things change over. We have different plates. We have different tablecloths, different silverware. It's a mess, okay? You don't want to be Jewish sometimes during the week of Passover. It's really, you know, it's tough. And the other one from the Bible is Moadim L'Simcha. May the festivals be for joy. Those are the two main greetings that you will hear in Israel if you were here during the, just before and coming up to the holiday, and it indicates where we are in our consciousness of being very much connected to our history, to our culture, our customs, and our religion.
A Hebrew lesson for you today. Well, Winky, as always, we appreciate your insight. We appreciate you educating us. You certainly do that. Thank you so much, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much, and goodbye to you and all our listeners.
Great job, as always, Winky. And Rick, let's bring in Shahram Haidian, born in Iran and a believer, and let's find out what Iranians are thinking about this whole thing.
Well, that's right, Jimmy. In our attempt to understand Iran's motivation, Iran's ideology, we are fortunate enough today to have with us Shahram Haidian from Truth and Love Ministry. Shahram, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you on the program.
Well, Shahram, you've been on the program many times. You've been a trusted broadcast partner of ours, but maybe this might be some of our listeners' first time hearing about you. Briefly, could you just let us know your background, your testimony?
Yeah, well, I have the privilege of being born again. I was originally born in Iran, born into a Muslim family, and we actually left that country. We fled that country just about 6 weeks before it fell back in 1979. My dad used to be in the military under the Shah of Iran, so we got out of there. And then, of course, Iran has been under the current regime for the last 46 years. But by the grace of God, back in 1999, almost 25 years ago, God put some very bold Christians in my life who shared the gospel with me. And by the power of the Holy Spirit, I got saved. I became a Christian, left Islam, and became a pastor. And now our ministry deals with many issues, of course, the Bible addresses, but first and foremost, it's the issue of Islam and dealing with evangelism to Muslims and making sure that we can continue to glorify the one true God, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Well, absolutely. It's fascinating testimony that you do have, and so people can understand your unique perspective as you come to comment with us today. We are trying to understand Iran's philosophy. We look at this situation. You talked about when the Shah was in power pre the Iranian Revolution, there was good relationships between Israel and Iran. The border, they don't share a common border. In fact, they're never closer than 1,000 miles, the two borders that you have there. But it certainly seems, especially with the Iranian leadership, the religious theocracy that is there, it certainly seems that their reason for existing is to eliminate the Jewish state of Israel. If you could you maybe give us a little bit of background on that, why that is so prevalent there? And is it countrywide? Is it everybody there, or is it just the leadership?
No, let me address the latter part of your question, because that's a great question. I get that asked all the time. Do the Iranian people that are in Iran, do they hate the Jews? Are they all anti-Semitic? Interestingly enough, Iran has the lowest anti-Semitism in the Middle East, at just apparently just around 50%. So, and the reason for that is because two things are happening. One, the Iranian people that live in Iran, they're sick of this Islamic Republic. They're sick of the government. They're sick of the tyranny that they've been under for the last 46 years. That's why last year you saw Iranians, especially female, you know, women in the streets, taking off their hijabs when Mahsa Amini, that young woman, was killed by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And they were shouting down with Islam, down with Khomeini, which is the supreme Islamic leader in Iran. So that's the first thing. Number two, there is a revival happening in Iran. The fastest growing church numerically in the world is in Iran among the Persian people, because Iranians are not Arabs, we're Persians. And I believe there's a very unique dichotomy and relationship that God has that created between Persia and Israel. We think it's the Bible. Think about Esther. Think about Daniel. Think about all those stories that happened in Persia. That was Persia, the Persian kings that God used to bring the Jews back out of captivity. And in fact, before 1979, as you mentioned, there were many Jews in Iran that Iran not only was an ally to the United States, Iran was an ally of Israel at that time. But once Islam came in, once Islam took over Iran, now we have the ideology shift. And that's really the heart of what we're dealing with, is that this isn't just because it's a nation-to-nation conflict. This is because the Islamic Republic of Iran, those ayatollahs, those religious leaders, they earnestly believe that it is their duty, under their God, their false God, to annihilate the Jewish people, because Islam teaches that the Jews have been corrupted and that they stole the covenant from Ishmael, from the Arabs, and that they are, in fact, the Quran calls Jews apes and pigs and monkeys. And the prophet of Islam himself said that when Jesus comes back, their false Jesus, that he was going to kill all the Jews. This is in text. This is in the text of Islamic theology, which is what governs the Iranian government and the regime.
So interesting, and also so full of hope, Christianity growing in Iran. And I'd like to talk about that in just a minute. Before I do, though, I came across an article this week, and this speaks to what you just told us. And the article was from a resident of Iran, and basically she was saying, we are more likely to be killed by the morality police than in an Israeli attack on Iran. She talks about that morality police, if you could explain a little bit what that is. But then she also said that there are some in Iran that hope that the IDF does attack Iran so that it could maybe spark and reignite those protests against the current regime.
Yeah, absolutely right. Because of the fact that, as I mentioned, I believe that the majority, more than 50-60% of the Iranian population, would support Israel, that does not hate the Jewish people, does not support Iran's belief that Israel must be wiped off the face of the earth. Of course, Iran calls Israel the little Satan, calls America the great Satan. But those people are, if you talk to them, they're like, listen, we'd rather endure Israeli airstrikes on key targets, our military, the nuclear facilities, the leadership. They want Israel to take out this Islamic Republican leadership. They want them to get rid of the IRGC, because the morality police is a faction of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The morality police, the best way to think about it is that they're the Sharia police. They're the ones who are going around and making sure that, okay, the women are wearing their hijab, their hair is not showing, they don't have makeup on, is too much of their legs showing, is too much of their arms showing. This is under Sharia. This is what Sharia is. That's why I warn Americans about allowing Sharia to take hold here in America and allowing Muslims to gain such political power, because the Iranian people, again, have lived it. And the morality police that last year beat Mahsa Amini in the head and she got brain bleed and then died subsequently, that's one of the reasons why they want a true revolution. They want the overthrow of this Islamic government. They're done with it. And they're open to, if Israel can help them, then so be it. So this is where the American mentality, where they do not want to see any direct airstrikes, as we just saw recently with the retaliation after the attacks on Saturday, the retaliation that Iran hit deep into Iran. Isfahan, where they hit, is a religious center. So I think that was Israel sending a message. We can hit you deep within the country, the capabilities, even though the U.S., in my opinion, betrayed Israel again and told them not to retaliate. So the Iranian people are for it if it brings down this regime.
So interested to hear basically what's an insider's perspective. And this is not the perspective that we necessarily get if you're just consuming the news. This is not how we necessarily understand Iran. In fact, and I'm sure you agree, I was so disappointed with the U.S. response when it came to supporting those protests against this authoritarian, brutal regime. We did not support them at all, did we?
We did not. And this is not the first time. This happened in 2009 under President Obama, when at that time there was something called the Green Movement. And it wasn't green like environmental. It was just green because they were claiming that was the color of freedom. And so they were trying to, at that time, rise up and say, Obama, will you just stand with us? They didn't want military. They didn't want money. They just wanted moral support. And same thing last year. The Iranian people wanted the moral support of America. And what did this administration do? They said nothing. They stood by and they said, you know, we're not going to interfere. It was the largest uprising since 1979. And in my opinion, a true revolution, where I would consider 79 more of a coup and an overthrow. This was a true revolution. Even the military were supporting the Iranian people. But then the Iranian regime brought outside militias in to try to stamp out the protests and the uprising. So I think Iran is primed. These are moments where, and in fact, in my opinion, I believe there's prophecy in Jeremiah 49 that deals with Elam, which is ancient Persia, that one day God will strike the bow of Elam. I'm praying one day the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will defeat this regime and allow the Iranian people to freely worship again. And hopefully, prayerfully, many of them who are going to be believers. It's incredible. If you look at that prophecy, it says that Jesus will set up a throne there. And the only place I've seen in the scriptures that Jesus sets up a throne is in Jerusalem. And this is the only other place it mentions that he would then set up a throne in Elam. So I think this is, of course, talking about the millennial reign. But it's incredible that there is even mention that God's going to strike the bow of Elam. God's going to defeat this regime and free the Iranian people, I believe, when he returns.
Well, so very fascinating. Well, let's move on. Just before you go, you have a ministry. It's called the Truth and Love Project. And basically, you have a kind of a twofold ministry. You seek to educate Christians about the Islamic world, but you also look to share the truth and love, thus the name, to Muslims. If you could, just before you go, could you talk a little bit about your work, the challenges involved, how God is using you, and how we could support you?
Yeah, thank you for that opportunity. It is a challenge because it is a twofold challenge. One, we seek to expose because many are confused about Islam. They believe that it is a peaceful ideology. They believe that it can coexist. They believe that that there's some sort of a spiritual common ground with Christianity. You know, today, one of the things we deal with in our ministry is exposing this lie that Islam is an Abrahamic faith, that somehow it worships the true God of Abraham, which it doesn't. It is not. It is the opposite. So one, we seek to expose, but also at the same time, we must reach these Muslims with the gospel of Jesus Christ. They are without hope. And in fact, currently, as I'm speaking with you, I'm on the road, and tonight I'm going to be doing evangelism training in Minnesota. I'm in the heart of Minnesota, Minneapolis, which is the largest Muslim population in America. And I'm going to be training a group of Christians on evangelism to Muslims here so that they can biblically and powerfully by the Holy Spirit go out and share the gospel. And also on our website now, we have our brand new gospel track. We just created a gospel track for Muslims that people can get on our website for a donation. But please visit that website. It's TILministry.com, TIL for Truth and Love Ministry.com, and they get all sorts of information. But this is the most unreached people group on the planet, and we have to be bold to reach to almost 2 billion Muslims, because if we don't, they are without hope. Of course, they have their agenda, but they are without hope. They're without salvation. And I'm sure glad somebody was bold enough to share the truth with me 25 years ago. And our ministry seeks to do that today with all of these Muslims that need the Lord Jesus Christ.
Well, we will certainly be praying for you. We urge our listeners to support your ministry as we do, Sharam. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your travels there in Minnesota to be with us today, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it. Always a pleasure. Look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you so much, Sharam. Excellent job. You know, and as we listen to Ken and Dave, Winky and Sharam, I hope you get the sense that the world, there's something brewing. And we've been talking about this ever since we started doing this program, ever since my father started doing it. And we are focusing on the nations. But it's a good thing, Rick, like you said at the outset of the program, it's a good thing that we have Bible prophecy so that we can understand what is happening. And really, we should be comforted by the fact that we do know how the end of the game is going to be played. And that's what we hope that you learn on this program. Well, we've got the Legacy Series coming up and Steve Herzig talking about Passover coming up at the end of the program today. Don't go anywhere. On Prophecy Today Weekend. Welcome back to Prophecy Today. I'm Jimmy DeYoung Jr. Along with Rick, we're examining current events in the light of God's prophetic word. As a ministry, we are so very encouraged by so many people that reach out to us and let us know how much you're learning Bible prophecy. And that is very encouraging to a ministry that's all about teaching Bible prophecy. There are so many other ministries that teach the Christian life. the spirit-filled life, all of those things. But this ministry just happens to be about using Bible prophecy to educate and edify the body of Christ, to help us to live pure, productive lives in an unholy world. That is for sure. And to understand why the world is acting as it is. And we want to thank all of our radio stations and partners that help us do this. Today on the Legacy Series with Dr. Jimmy DeYoung, we're going to continue our study on the book of Zechariah. However, I want you first to go to the second chapter of the book of Ezra, where we see the Lord speaking of a political leader and a priestly leader of the Jewish people who will be returning from Babylon to Jerusalem. You've got to remember that the Medo-Persian king Cyrus has allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. Please make notice that according to Ezra chapter 2, all 12 tribes of Israel go back into the land that God had promised them. And you may wonder, what about Zechariah? Well, Dr. DeYoung is teaching the book of Zechariah, but we need this background first. Please, if you will, go to the book of Ezra chapter 2. Dr. Jimmy DeYoung and the Legacy Series.
In chapter 2, we start to see now those who are going to come out and go back to Babylon. Look at verse 2. Which came with Zerubbabel and Yeshua, or Joshua. Either pronunciation is appropriate. Yeshua, the word that in Hebrew means Savior, and the word that is used to speak of Jesus Christ, if you're in the land, Yeshua, or Joshua, represents the priestly aspect of those who are going to be coming into the land. He is a longtime priest. He was the chief priest at that point in time. He's going to be one of the main characters in the book of Zechariah. And Zerubbabel was of the line of King David. He was in the line that would come to and bring forth the Messiah. And he was the political leader. So you have the religious leader and the political leader being raised up. And then chapter 2 unfolds. All of those are going to be coming out. Look at verse 36. The priests, the children, and he explains the house of Yeshua, those priests that will be coming out. And in fact, he gives the number 4,289 priests are going to be coming into the land. Now, chapter 3 of the book of Ezra. I am teaching Zechariah, but I've got to give you an undergirding for what's going to happen in Zechariah. Chapter 3, and when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in their cities, by the way, in chapter 2 it said they all went to their cities, and by the way, I want you to notice something. Over here, let me just show you something very interesting. In verse 28, the men of Bethel, and in verse 29, the children of Nebo, in chapter 2. That is saying that both the northern tribes and the southern tribes, all of Israel, not just Judah. It names it. You see, Bethel was one of the capital cities of the 10 northern tribes called Israel. And so now they're all coming back into the land. And they're back into the land, and Zerubbabel and Joshua are going to have to do something. Verse 1 of chapter 3. And when the seventh month was coming, the children of Israel were in the land. That's why it uses the word Israel there instead of Judah. You see, Israel is used three ways in the scriptures. It's used to describe Jacob because God changed his name in Genesis chapter 32 to Jacob, from Jacob to Israel. It's used to describe all 12 tribes, and it's used to describe the 10 tribes in the north. But now they're all back in the land, so he's using Israel here. They were gathered back into their own cities. The people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. Then stood up Yeshua and his brethren, the priest, and Zerubbabel and his brethren, and they builded the altar of God of Israel to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. They had a responsibility. The book of Leviticus lays out the sacrificial activities, what they're supposed to do. So they went to Mount Moriah, where the temple stood, Solomon's temple stood. They went up onto the Temple Mount, and they built an altar there so the burnt sacrifices could be offered up at that point in time. But all they built was the altar at that point in time. Now, this is about 536 B.C., Look what happens in verse 8. Now, in the second year of their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, look over in verse 10, when the builders laid the foundation of the temple, they put the altar up, they built the foundation of the temple, and at that point, they ceased their work. So they had the altar on the Temple Mount. They had the foundation for the temple laid there on the Temple Mount. But that's all they did. And then as we look at chapter 4 and chapter 5, we will see external oppression that's going to keep them from building the temple. But in addition to the external oppression, we will see internal depression. A group of Jews that have been in the captivity, 50,000 of them, actually 49,827 I think to be exact, come out of the land, out of 2 million people. They've left their families, they're back in the city of Jerusalem. They've heard stories, some of them have lived through this period of captivity. They realized what Solomon's temple was like, a majestic building. They've got the altar up, they've got the foundation up on the Temple Mount, and there they sit. And because of external oppression, internal depression, they're not going to be able to build the temple, or they're going to keep from building the temple. And from 536 to 520 BC, 16 years, they don't do a thing about building the temple. Now we move to chapter 5 of the book of Ezra. Chapter 5. Then the prophets Haggai and the prophet Zechariah are raised up. If you're reading the book of Ezra, when you come to chapter 5, verse 1, that's when you read the book of Haggai and Zechariah. These two prophets are raised up. A young man who is a prophet priest, Zechariah. He's young because Zechariah 2:4 says he was a young man. He's a man who has been born during the Babylonian captivity. Isn't that interesting? The only one of the prophets to be born during the Babylonian captivity and comes into the land and prophesies in the land. Daniel and Ezekiel, born in Israel, go into Babylonian captivity and prophesy. And so this man is going to come back into the land, and he's going to be a young man, he's going to prophesy. But before Zechariah prophesies, Haggai prophesies. They prophesy in the same year. They're contemporaries. They know each other. One is a very practical, pragmatic prophet. That's Haggai. The other is a visionary. He has a desire to motivate the people, getting the message from God that he must communicate to them and tell them why they need to build the temple. Haggai, the pragmatic prophet, he starts to prophesy in the month of September in the second year of Darius, which would be the year 520 BC. And he starts to prophesy in September. He has actually four messages in two chapters, second smallest book in the Bible, in the Old Testament anyway. Obadiah is smaller. And he's got two chapters here. He gives four messages over a four-month period of time. He comes out of obscurity. He goes into obscurity. We don't know where he came from. We don't know where he went to. And we don't know much about him, except he's an older man. He probably saw the majestic aspect of Solomon's temple. Now he comes out, and it's so practical. He gets down on his hands and knees, measuring the location for the temple, giving them the details of how to build the temple, and at the same time he's out there working with his sleeves rolled up, he's telling the people, you got to build this temple. He prophesies in September. He gets the second message in October. Then in November, Zechariah gets his message, the beginning of his message anyway, in December. By the way, if you want to check that out, look with me. Look over to Haggai. We're coming out. Hold it. Don't leave. Just a second. Just before you leave Ezra, they are going to complete the temple. In chapter 6 of Ezra, we see they complete the temple. Verse 15, and the house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which is March, the last month of the year, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius. So it took them 4 years to finish the temple. They dedicate the temple, and then Ezra comes into Jerusalem to reinstitute the temple practices. But get over to Haggai just for a second. And it tells us that his first prophecy in chapter 1, verse 1, was in the sixth month, which is the month of September. And then as you look down to the second one in chapter 2, in the seventh month, that's the month of October, verse 10, and in the fourth and 20th day of the ninth month, that's the month of December. By the way, that's an interesting date, the 24th of December, he starts this prophecy. Some interesting connections between our Christmas and the prophets and what they do at interesting times of the year. Anyway, that's the book of Haggai. Now look over to Zechariah. Let's get to Zechariah, and let's start this study. This is a bit of a background. He's a contemporary. He's coming out of the Babylonian captivity. He's now going to be responsible for exhorting the Jewish people to build the temple. Look here in chapter 1, verse 1. And in the eighth month of the second year of Darius came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet. And then he starts to say to them in chapter 1. In chapter 1 he says, look, you people are just like your fathers. You didn't pay attention during the time of your fathers to the prophets that were raised up. Now your fathers are gone, those prophets are gone, my word is still true, and I'm telling you, you've got a responsibility. And he's going to start to get their attention by coming on with an exhortation to pay attention to the word of God. And this is given to him, this first bit of information is given to him in the first couple of verses. But there's something really interesting in the titles of the names of the prophet, his father, and his grandfather. Look here what it says in verse 1. He raises up a man. The word came unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet, saying. You know what Zechariah means? Zechariah in the Hebrew means God remembers. Jehovah remembers. That's what Zechariah means. You know what Berechiah means, his father? Jehovah blesses. You know what his grandfather's name, Iddo, means? At the appointed time. Isn't that interesting? That little trio says, Jehovah remembers. What does he remember? He remembers the covenants he gave to the Jewish people. He remembered his responsibility. Somebody said the other day, well, God is finished with the Jewish people. Hey, if God is finished with the Jewish people, he never started with me. Because if he can break a promise to the Jew, I can't believe any promise he ever made to me. He has to fulfill the promise he made to the Jewish people. And that's what Zechariah's name says. Zechariah, Jehovah remembers. Berechiah. Not only does he remember, he's promised to bless the Jewish people. Jehovah blesses. And then his grandfather's name enters into the whole scenario of what's going to happen. Iddo, which means he not only remembers, he not only blesses, but he does it at the appointed time. And that's what Zechariah is giving us, the information of the appointed time when God will remember and God will bless the Jewish people as he's promised to do. And we, 2,500 years after the fact, are able to get a message. I mean, I don't know if this turns you on or not, but it gets me excited. 2,500 years after the fact, God has given us the information to tell us when that appointed time is about to be, when he's going to remember and he's going to bless those he's promised to do that to. Ooh, boy, that's just the first verse, and look how exciting it is already.
What a very exciting study we've just completed on the book of Zechariah. Zechariah, interpreted, means God remembers. His father's name means God blesses, and his grandfather's name, he does this, God remembers and blesses at the appointed time. Well, we've just got through Zechariah chapter 1 and verse 1, and you do not want to miss the other verses in chapter 1. That's next time as we continue our study of Zechariah. Please join us at that time.
Dr. Jimmy DeYoung and the Legacy Series. If you want to find out more about what we have on our website, please go to prophecytoday.com and you can look in our bookstore. So many things to help you along in your study. We'll be right back with Steve Hertzik as he talks about Passover right here on Prophecy Today Weekend.
I'm Todd Morris for Ruth Kramer with Mission Network News. While Iran stirs up growing conflict abroad, their own house is not in order. Tehran entered 2024 without an official budget. Lana Silk with Transform Iran says the people are struggling economically and angry with the government.
They feel completely trapped in the world that they live in right now. And as far as they're concerned, they are forgotten by the West, because all the West sees is their regime with all the negative things at play that the regime is involved in. And so then the West must hate us.
Some Iranians are even questioning the validity of Islam itself. Transform Iran uses television, radio, and social media to reach seekers with the good news about Jesus. Please pray for the people of Iran to know truth and comfort in the gospel. And nearly half of the 50 states in America have legalized recreational marijuana in recent years, and five more could vote to do so in November. The Lighthouse's Brandon Bauer says, even if cannabis is legal in your state, that doesn't make it safe to consume.
Picture this. You've got a drug dealer cutting up their cocaine on a table, packaging it, and then they're cutting up their weed on the same table. People are dying from cross-contamination. We're seeing so much fentanyl in the marijuana here in Indiana. It's crazy.
Despite knowing the risks, roughly 18% of Americans used cannabis last year. Christ can and does break the powerful chains of addiction. If you're looking for a biblical approach to addiction recovery, connect with the Lighthouse at missionnews.org.
Getting help with any addictive substance is a wise move, and the Lighthouse wants to help you with that.
Mission Network News is a listener-supported service of One Way Ministries. Bibles for the World is giving away a free copy of the book, The Legacy of William Carey. Get your copy when you click the banner at missionnews.org. I'm Dodd Morris.
Well, a friend throughout the year, especially at the time of the feast, high holy days, the high holidays, if you will, Steve Herzig. Welcome to the program again, Steve.
Hey, Jimmy. Always good to be with you.
Steve is he's a national director of North America for Friends of Israel. I encourage you to go to their website. Well, let's talk about the Passover. The Passover is starting this week. Specifically, we want to talk about the three spring feasts, Passover, Unleavened Bread, and the Feast of First Fruits. So the first feast of the year, the festival calendar, is Passover. And we understand that from the book of Leviticus chapter 23. Tell us a little bit about what we should know about Passover.
Well, Jimmy, the main thing you should know about Passover, and really what is the least emphasized amongst Jewish people is since the destruction of the temple, is the lamb. Mm. The lamb is the feature of this, specifically the blood of the lamb. And, you know, in Exodus chapter 12, in verse 3, it says, "Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the tenth of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household's too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons, according to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. Then it says, your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You shall take it from the sheep or from the goats." So the idea is the lamb, Jimmy. The blood has to be applied. Exodus chapter 12 tells us that. It's to be applied on the lintels. And God says, when I see the blood, I'll pass over. And the verses you alluded to in Leviticus chapter 23, and by the way, Jimmy, I always say this, Leviticus is that book that most of us in our Bibles have the pages still stuck together. But this particular chapter is so important. Verse 4 of Leviticus 23 said, "These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim." That's what you're doing, Jimmy, on the radio. We're proclaiming these feasts, and we're not communicating them primarily to the Jewish people, as Moses was writing here. But we are, during this time of the church age, proclaiming these words because they tie in to the church. We're not bound under the law. Mm. But if we can get an understanding of these feasts, it's going to help us glorify God. It's going to help us understand the plan and the workings of God, because I believe all seven feasts really tell a prophetic picture of what God has in store for the nation of Israel and his people, the Jewish people. So you have this picture of the blood has to be on the doorpost. You have matzah, unleavened bread, and leaven is always symbolic of sin. The rabbis say in the Haggadah, we use a Haggadah which tells us the story of Passover. Mm-hmm. And you're right, Jimmy, you have the unleavened bread. Rabbis say that represents the evil inclination of the heart. Jimmy, think about that. Leaven. I don't know what most of your listeners have when they do communion. I've been to numbers of different churches mm-hmm. and denominations, and they do it differently. But I will say this, if they're not using matzah or some sort of unleavened bread, they're doing it injustice. Because in Matthew chapter 26, Jimmy, Jesus held the matzah. He wasn't holding marble rye or Italian sourdough. Or
right.
He wasn't holding pumpernickel or even Wonder Bread. He was holding unleavened bread because he was celebrating Passover. Yep. And then he said this, Jimmy, this is my body. That's significant because Jesus had just been on the earth 33 years as a man, 100% man, and there was no sin found in him. Oh, they tried. They tried to find sin in mm-hmm. his life and in his work, but they couldn't find any because there was no sin in him. And then he held up the cup. And you know what's interesting, Jimmy, is in Exodus chapter 6, and Jewish people do this to this very day, there are four cups of wine during the Passover. And we know from the Talmud, which is extra biblical, that these cups existed during the first century when Jesus was walking the earth and on the earth. And listen to where these cups come from, because they're vital in understanding the communion that he established in Matthew chapter 26. In verse 6 of Exodus, it says, "Therefore say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and here's the first cup. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians." So bringing them out from the burdens of the Egyptians, that's the first cup mm-hmm. that's taken at Passover. "I will rescue you from their bondage." Rescue from your bondage. That's the second cup. And listen to the third cup, for this was the cup that Jesus held up in Matthew chapter 26, when it says in Exodus 6, "I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments." Mm. In other words, Jimmy, this third cup that Jesus was taking, using Passover as a background, he was now instituting a new, under the new covenant, under his blood, a cup of what's called redemption. Mm. It's so exciting to me to realize that he used redemption of slavery of Egypt as a background, as something they knew, to institute for you and me redemption out of the marketplace of sin and to freedom. So they're going to the promised land. Jimmy, you and I are going up to meet Jesus Christ, and what a day that will be.
And that fourth cup,
The fourth cup is the cup in Matthew that he did not take.
Right.
He'll do it with later. And that fourth cup says, "I will," that's future tense, "I will take you to be my people and I will be your God." And he said, "I'll drink that henceforth when you're with me." So he didn't drink that fourth cup. We're waiting to drink that cup with him.
Steve, thank you so much for being with us this week and explaining to us, as you do always, about the Jewish holidays, and especially this time, the Passover holiday.
Hey, Jimmy, always good to be with you.
While it is not required for Christians to celebrate the Passover, it is beneficial to study it and could be beneficial to celebrating it if it leads to a greater understanding and appreciation for Christ's death and resurrection. The Passover is a wonderful picture of Christ's atonement for his people and his deliverance of us from the bondage of sin. That is something we should celebrate every day of our lives, and at least until the rapture of the church takes place. And until then, let's keep looking up until.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Jay Johnson inviting you to join us again next week for more of Prophecy Today.